cause of many, if not most, of the crimes. I'm not saying it's a cause. It's involved in the crimes. And essentially what we do is we dry them out in jail or prison because we don't keep them on drugs. They go back into the community and fall right back into drugs.
You don't keep them on drugs, but apparently there's quite
We don't intend to keep them on drugs. It's not our intent. And I say that in that we don't do the methadone as they do in some other states, particularly New York. But you're absolutely correct. Drugs do enter prison. And any time you have access between the public and inmates, as we do in prisons and in contact visiting, you're going to have drugs in. Drugs can come in other ways. I've had this problem in my own jails. You continue to be diligent. You continue to do random urinalysis to identify those that are getting them. But you cannot keep everything out. It is completely impossible to do that. I served on the president's, as a presidential appointee by President Reagan, to the White House Conference for Drug-Free America. And one of the dilemmas that the conference went through last May in its final deliberations was that there isn't a great deal known about successful drug treatment programs. There are individuals who will claim that they're successful programs, and I think there are some. That doesn't mean we shouldn't try to do something. We have to do things. And I think there are some successes around. What the White House conference recommended was that the administration and Congress designate, and my recollection was the Science Foundation, do the necessary research to identify and duplicate, identify the successful programs around the country, and then be prepared to, through technology transfer, get that out to the communities. We're not only talking about non-incarcerative types of treatments, but also those that are ones in which the general public can participate in. Currently, there are just not enough programs available. If someone in Multnomah County is sentenced on probation, conditioned on being in a drug program, they may wait 30 to 60 days to be even examined for the program. And if I'm walking in off the street and need drug treatment in one of these programs, I will wait 6 months. Well, I think it's quite obvious that if I'm a drug addict and I'm burgling to feed my habit or doing other kinds of crimes that are ones in which I can raise funds, I'm going to continue doing it and probably forget that I wanted to do 6 months ago to go into a program. That's an area that is sadly lacking, and it was recognized by the task force.
Okay,
I have one other.
Yeah,
I know.
I want to follow up on this one.
Oh, you want to follow up on the DNA on drug and alcohol?
Yeah.
Oh, please do that.
One quick question.
Sure.
To get
no,
back
no.
To you.
That's
fine. I guess if this committee comes up with a package of discretionary funds, which could be accessed by local community nonprofits and programs that are existing for expansion, replication, and training of people to start additional programs that we know are successful. Would you be the kind of person who would be down in Ways and Means saying, we don't want to do this? Because we've gotten some additional requests from the governor's office that says we want to accelerate some things, and if the legislature decides that along with accelerating some things and putting some additional money in, that we want to put this side, we want to bring this side up to standard as well. What's your position? And I know you got to check with the governor, but I need to know how you feel about it personally as a follow-up to Senator Shoemaker's.
Philosophically, I'm very supportive of those. I personally contracted with several programs, both with general fund county money that was discretionary for that purpose, and with community corrections funds, with Carol Pope, with the YW, with several programs. I think we have to continue to try to find the private sector programs at work. And my philosophy is, and again, I would have to check with the governor, obviously, but my philosophy is that it is absolutely necessary that we provide the tools in the community to assist those people who leave prison and jail, to assist those people who may be sentenced to probation conditioned on having those kinds of facilities and programs available. If we're going to do anything to change behavior, it is going to be those kinds of programs that people will accept and take advantage of. We don't rehabilitate anybody, but we have to provide the means with which they can rehabilitate themselves. And many people need that kind of transitional service, if you will, as we do with the Carol Pope program and the YW program in my own county. And I'm very supportive of that, Senator.
Good. Senator Shoemaker.
One other area I'd like to look into a little bit. Many of the people that are in our prisons, their lifestyle is in part due to the fact that they can't even read.
That's true.
There have been suggestions that we ought to put more emphasis on, while they're there, trying to give them some of the basic skills that maybe they will use if they wish to get themselves out of the rut they're in, and thus some kind of a literacy program, maybe even one that's required. Have you some thoughts on that?
Well, I'm certainly supportive of the literacy program and operate GED programs in the jail, recognizing that jail is a short-term incarceration, so you don't have some of the long-term, those that are very, very illiterate. However, we've had a fairly good success rate in Multnomah County of that, and I'm supportive of that in the prisons. There are already some literacy programs in the prisons, GED programs, some college programs. I'm very supportive of those kind of programs. As to whether it's mandated, it's one of those things you may be able to induce people to go, but it takes sanctions if you're going to say you do this or else. And I'd have to look at what those trade-offs would be. But that's another area that I think we have to spend some money on and push for. I would like to see every prisoner in our system that's in our custody have work, vocational education, or just study of some kind as part of their everyday occupation. And that's a tall order in our current prison systems.
But if the head of the Department of Corrections thinks it's important enough, it's probably not an order that can't be filled.
I agree with that, sir.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, just a couple of things. First, I think the Sheriff's Association has called for legislation, more anti-drug legislation, and I know that my caucus has Senate Republicans and a member of the Citizens for a Drug-Free Oregon, which does. Do you view your position here in this new position as one to push for stronger anti-drug legislation, or do you maybe in fact think it's going to cause you more trouble? You'll be the recipient of quite a few additional inmates. Where are you going to lay in there?
I am very supportive of our ability to deal with our drug problem in a variety of ways. And I'm kind of stepping around this in the sense and trying to get to the fact that I'm committed to sentencing guidelines. The sentencing guidelines, unfortunately, because of the prison space thing, I think may create some problems of not providing sufficient sanctions for people who are committed as a result of drug crimes. We are doing nothing effective currently because that is considered a nonviolent crime, and nonviolent crimes in this state get very little sanction. Again, it's a dollar and cents issue. What are we going to put people in prison for and for how long? And I have to defer, not having been a party to the sentencing guidelines and deliberations, that at least this time, that's their best judgment. And unless additional prison space is put online, I'm not sure that should take precedence over some other crimes that they have determined to be of a higher priority. I'm very supportive of doing that, but it's how much is it going to cost, and how much is the legislature willing to put out?
Would your priority be to try to get the additional space?
I'm most happy to try to get additional space. Okay. I think I have a history of that.
One last thing. you seem to have an uncanny ability to get some bad press from time to time. And in relationship, this calls for administrative management skills, of course,
right,
is what it is. You got a bad audit reported in the paper.
A what?
County audit. There were some complaints.
Oh.
County audit.
Sure.
I'd like you to respond to those.
Well, it was rather interesting, keeping in mind that the county auditor is also an elected official. And what was declared to be a management audit actually was as a result of my asking the county auditor to come in and look at my fiscal management unit and make recommendations for change. I had on several occasions in the previous years asked for additional staff in my fiscal unit from the Board of County Commissioners. And they were not so inclined to build on infrastructure any place in the county, let alone mine, but they didn't in the central county general services at that time either. When the report came out, I was quite shocked because it talked about management of the agency. And in fact, they looked at two units only, a total of six people out of my 630-person operation, my planning unit and my fiscal unit, which I didn't have enough staff in either one, and said they were not able to provide me with the information I needed to make decisions. Well, and that we were late with our budget every year. I'm not sure that I wasn't provided with enough information to make my decisions. There's no question we were late with our budget. But I, you know, my response to that is that it was not an agency audit. It was, you know, a management audit of the agency, which I'd have been happy to have if that's what we had started out to do. And they, in fact, looked at the management of the agency instead of two small units that I'd repeatedly asked for additional staff for.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Grinsky.
Sheriff, one thing I've seen sitting on the Judiciary Committee here is that a lot of people have dedicated a tremendous amount of energy and time to crime and corrections reform and actually, you know, getting the state of Oregon moving in the right direction. And I've been really very impressed by that. So it causes me a little concern when the guy that's going to be the head of the ship responds, and maybe, you know, you just didn't think it was that important, but when you were asked to describe why you're interested in serving for the state of Oregon, you say, the governor asked me. I would have preferred, I'm gonna kick rear and take names and no prisoners or something. You know, I want somebody who's going to really be putting in the long hours and making sure this thing is going to fly, because business as usual isn't cutting it in this state. And if your real reason is that the governor asked you and it'd be great and everything, I'm wondering if you really want this job.
When I answered that way, it was not meant to be flippant. Let me make that clear. But that is the reason I accepted the job, is because the governor asked me to take the job. I would not have accepted the job if I didn't want the job. I think it's the most challenging job in this state government today, of a ship that's sinking, certainly meaning corrections, not the state. And I think that I bring with me the skills and the background to be able to put my finger in the dike for a while, get some of these things built, and make a difference in our crime that is occurring in our state today. And until we get sufficient beds to do that, if you took that comment as flippant, I apologize. It was not meant that way at all.
Oh, that's why I asked.
Yes.
Because I
certainly
throw these types of things out, and sometimes I just want to get through it. And you knew you'd be interviewed.
I knew I'd be interviewed. And I didn't give as much thought to having that filled out as I probably should, and I apologize for that.
I appreciate that.
Anything else? Actually, I, in the interest of time, I do have a support resolution from the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. Bill Brooks is here, and this is signed by Sheriff Earl Tarno from the president of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. Do you need to say anything, folks, beyond the resolution?
I would like to.
Okay.
This is Sheriff Armato.
Well, I understand that. Come on up, then.
Be sure.
Please.
Do you want me to sit back or stay
here? Go ahead.
Madam Chairman, committee members, like I told you, I'm Sheriff Bill Arnato. On behalf of the criminal justice system of Josephine and Jackson County, we strongly support the governor's selection of Fred Pierce as director. As you know, Fred brings over 35 years, but he has some unique and vital assets to the Community Correction Division. One, he's earned the respect and support of all the sheriffs and criminal justice members of Oregon and Washington. He understands, too, he understands the correction problems on a state level, but most important, he understands it on a county level, which those two agencies must work together, and that's been part of the problem in this state. Three, he has the knowledge, experience, and most important, the desire to work with the governor, the legislators, and county government to solve Oregon's crisis in inmate population management. And I think most important, Fred is a man of integrity. He's not going to tell you just what you want to hear. He's going to tell you what you have to hear. And that's hard to buy. And my Senator Ron, being fair to Fred here, there's many, many times.
Go ahead. We're really under a time pressure.
I'm going to get out of here, but I think just signed up on the bills. I think about resigning, and I get bad press all the time, too. That's part of the game, and as political people, you know it. Thank you.
Senator Shoemaker, thank you very much.
If there are no further witnesses, I would move the committee recommend to the Senate the confirmation of the appointment of Fred Pierce as the head of the Department of Corrections.
I would just like to say before we vote, assuming that we do confirm this gentleman, that I wish him the best of luck and hope you will kick rear out there because we need him.
And I think I can say from knowing a little bit about the county that you can expect that that will occur.
Great.
Madam Chair, I have just one very quick question of the, you don't have to come up. Pronounce your last name for me. Pierce.
Pierce, like the pocket.
Okay, thank you. So
thank
we don't
you.
Know who we're talking about here.
Further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Senator Brennan?
Aye.
Senator Brockman?
Aye.
Senator Frenzy?
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker?
Aye.
Senator Paul? Aye. Motion carried. Thank you very much. Thank you, folks, for coming. Let's take up a in work session Senate Bill 558, which is a bill which we haven't seen as this committee, and it would be my request that we it would be my motion that we send, that I move Senate Bill 558 to the desk for re-referral to the Committee on Telecommunications and Consumer Affairs. This has been a request of Senator Jolin. It is her bill. The President's office has suggested that would be okay, so I would move that Senate Bill 558 be referred to the desk for re-referral purposes. Are there discussion? Call the roll, please.
Oh.
Aye.
Aye.
It's just a motion to refer.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you very much. Now we also have a bill for introduction. It's LC 3448. The requester is the Oregon Department of Justice. It requires persons who have committed sex offenses to submit blood sample for forensic analysis. And it does deal with the specifics of procedure for taking such a sample. It has, again, the requester is the Oregon Department of Justice, has come to us from the Rules Committee. I would, are there objections to us introducing LC 3448 at as a committee bill? Hearing none, so ordered. Then let's move into our, I guess we have some witnesses who are not here yet, Catherine. Who haven't seen? Elizabeth Stockdale is
here. I think they're either out in the hall or I can round them up.
Okay, move to House Bill 2192, the bill that we've had hearings on before. It is scheduled for public hearing and work session today. We have had amendments requested. We've had testimony on those amendments. The committee requested that Elizabeth Stocktail and Richard Munn come to us to talk about the confidentiality of tax records. And they are here. Elizabeth? Yes, why don't you go ahead, Catherine?
Okay. The Dash 3 amendments are submitted from the Forest Product Council. You have in front of you a hand-engrossed version of them. They're Dash 3. You also have a hand-engrossed bill. The Dash 3 amendments, first of all, retain the emergency clause, and second, make the amendments retroactive to cover all information that has not yet been disclosed. They prohibit disclosure of the particulars from the timber tax returns and the amount of taxes. Those two items can't be disclosed. It doesn't prohibit disclosure for regulatory or enforcement.
Right. You weren't clear on your doesn't.
Okay.
Does
all right.
Not.
Does not prohibit disclosure for regulatory or enforcement purposes, and would still allow disclosure when it is in the public interest.
Sometimes Catherine's Boston accent gets in the way of the tape understanding exactly what it says. Okay. And we have Elizabeth here, who is the from the AG's office, who drafted the opinion that is been at issue here, I would say. Go ahead, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Elizabeth Stocktail, attorney in charge of the tax section of the Department of Justice. I understand that you're considering amendments that would protect timber tax returns from disclosure. I'm not certain how much you want to talk about the opinion. We advised the Revenue Department that currently there was no statutory provision that precluded disclosure of timber tax returns.
I suppose the committee was interested in why in 1977 or previous to that time there was an attorney general that said they were confidential, and then in intervening years we get yet another AG opinion. So is there any, what happened in the time, or is it just the sort of difference of opinion of attorney generals, or what happened in the intervening time to make you or make the attorney general, whoever they were, change their mind about all this?
Well, the situation was that an opinion had been given in 1976 or 1977, and in 1987 or 1988, there was a request under the public records law asking for information from timber tax returns. The department asked us again to make sure what the status of the returns was. I reviewed that prior opinion and determined that there really was no basis for the conclusion. And I advised the department that there was no statutory protection for the returns.
Okay. Any questions for Elizabeth with respect to this?
Anything about 77 was when you
okay, Richard, why don't you go ahead and discuss it more if you want to kind of lay it out for us.
I don't know what I was just saying you might want to remember, at least historically, that 1970.
Your name for the record.
I'm sorry, Richard Munn, Director of the Department of Revenue. You might want to remember 1977 is when actually we adopted a severance tax. That session worked through the old ad valorem system that used to be on the rolls for timber, and changed it to the kind of severance tax you have today. And virtually, the law has not been changed much since that 1977 period.
We've all sort of went away to meet with the interested parties to try to figure out whether there might be some opportunity to gather information or to request information from the Revenue Department that came short of disclosing exact information that was company-specific, with company names and specific tax return related. Catherine, you want to?
Part of the question comes down to, you use the word particulars, and Elizabeth, you know, is that a term of art in the statutes, and what particularly does it mean?
In the income tax law, there is a specific statute that protects information described as particulars of a report or return from disclosure. And the Oregon Court of Appeals has interpreted that statute to refer to the items that go to calculation of tax liability. In the income tax return context, we would be talking about income items such as amount of wages, amount of investment income, dividends, interest, deduction amounts such as expenses, cost of goods, those kinds of particular pieces of information that a taxpayer includes on the return in order to calculate tax. That's what particulars are in the income tax sense, and using the same word here, we would probably construe that in the same sense, since it refers to returns as well.
At what level of summary information does it no longer become a particular? Do you have an opinion about that?
Well, a particular from a return, obviously, is a precise piece of information. When you're talking about confidentiality and maintaining the anonymity of information, you would have to have, and accumulating information, you would be accumulating enough so that it would not be possible for anyone from outside to determine what component of that accumulated information belonged to whom. So you'd be talking about, I suppose, three or more pieces of identical information being accumulated before you'd have that assured anonymity.
So if you summarized reports and had three reports summarized, it would no longer be considered confidential information?
It would not be a particular from a report or return at that point. It would be summary information in another document.
All right. Thank you.
Is the Department of Revenue supportive of this amendment?
Yes, we are supportive of the amendment. We're used to working, in effect, with our records that most of our records are, in effect, confidential. We do try to provide, like with the income tax and the corporate excise tax, statistical information so other people can analyze what the effects of either changes in the law or the effects of the law itself are on different groups of people, not an individual. And to that extent, we would attempt also to provide statistical information about the timber tax so that people that are interested can sort of find out maybe by market area or region of the state what's going on in a general sense, not specific to an individual taxpayer.
Madam Chair, does this list of amendments then make the timber tax returns
essentially the same degree of protection as income tax returns enjoy?
I think Elizabeth can answer, but I think the answer is no.
Madam Chair, that's correct. The answer is no. It's not the same level of protection.
Okay. What is this fundamental difference between the two?
Under the income tax statute that protects income tax returns, the only time the Department of Revenue may disclose a return or an item off of an individual return is to the taxpayer, to the taxpayer's authorized representative, or to a court that is making a determination about tax liability with respect to that return. Other courts cannot subpoena those records for other purposes. It's protected that extensively.
Insofar as gathering general information from income tax returns as a group, as you just testified, I take it that kind of compilation of data is available of income tax returns, is that right?
Yes, annually.
You just justified that it was.
Yeah, annually we put out statistical information on income tax returns. Annually, we pull a sample of those, and because your Legislative Revenue Office, and Terry's here from Legislative Revenue, does analysis and is also subject to the Secrecy Clause having access to that information, they do analysis off those returns to help you deal with different tax law changes, estimates of revenue effects of changing the income tax in one way or another.
And that same kind of data could be pulled from timber tax returns,
yes,
I assume, under existing law. never been any question about that.
Right. You could aggregate the data, and in effect, I think part of what Rick has been doing with others is trying to look at different aggregations of information and see if that meets some of their needs from the computer records they currently have.
This then goes farther than that and allows particular, I shouldn't use the word particular, allows data specific to a particular taxpayer to be pulled from that taxpayer's return by anyone who inquires. Is that?
Currently, the interpretation of the Justice Department is if somebody asks for an individual return on the timber tax, yes, that we would, under the law, would need to give
it. But I mean, with this, if this bill is passed,
Yes, I'd need to clarify Elizabeth's comment. So when you said no so emphatically that this amendment would not provide an equivalent confidentiality, then we need to know what you mean when you say no.
Okay, well, that's what I was explaining about the...
We're talking about the amendment now. We're
right.
Not talking about existing status quo.
Okay, I was trying to explain the difference between this bill and the income tax protections that we currently have on income tax returns.
Okay. Corey, are you prepared to come up and deal with 516?
I thought that's what the television was
what
all about.
On which?
I said I thought that's what the television was all about.
Closed circuit testimony.
Okay, do you have anything further with respect? We sort of short shifted people's testimony last time because we got involved in timely.
Madam Chair, there was a Corey Streisinger, Governor Goldschmidt's legal counsel. There was discussion about Senate Bill 516 last time. My prepared testimony has been distributed to the committee, and I did review it briefly. I see no need to repeat it at this time, but I would be pleased to answer any questions or if there are areas the committee would like me to amplify.
We will get you here during work session and during consideration of any amendments, and thank you. Let's go to John Collins, who is
Madam Chair,
signed up.
Madam Chair, can I ask one quick question?
Yes.
Corey, who has access to the video under this bill? For instance, is there ever a possibility that end up on the evening news under some action? Is somebody trying to get a hold of that under Freedom of Information Act or something?
Madam Chair, Senator Brenneman, that is not covered by this bill. As you're probably aware, the Oregon Supreme Court has recently determined that cameras will be allowed in the courtroom, but there are some exemptions for cases involving sex crimes, which these bills would apply to. Portions of the videotape, which are, if there is a videotape deposition or a closed circuit, portions which are presented in open court would be part of the record, the same as any other evidence that is shown in open court. But the availability of that to the evening news, I believe, would be governed by that rule adopted by the Oregon Supreme Court. I have not, however, looked at that issue in any detail. Portions which are not used in court, I see no reason that they would become part of a record or public.
But this only really covers the times when a prosecutor might feel there's going to be emotional, psychological harm to a young person that it's chosen to be used. Won't be used in every instance.
Madam Chair, Senator Brenneman, that's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let's call John Collins, if you'd like to come up, please, John.
Testimony, and I'll try to summarize that now. We believe the intent of the bill is to make it possible for a child to testify by videotape deposition where live trial testimony would cause the child severe emotional or psychological harm. In other words, the intent is to make it easier for the child witness. District Attorneys Association strongly believes that unless the amendment is added, the bill will make it harder on the child, not easier. If the defendant has the ability to move the court for an order deposing the child, the defendant would, at a minimum, have the ability to require the child to submit to a psychological examination to support the defense motion. Even if the effort to order a deposition goes no further, the defendant has subjected the child to further invasion and trauma and may even further frighten the child into recanting or withholding truthful testimony. If the defense gets a psychologist to say the child would be severely emotionally or psychologically harmed by testifying in person, The defense could thereby force the child to submit to a deposition. In such a deposition, defense counsel and or the defendant is more likely to attempt to intimidate the child since his or her actions would be less evident to a jury. The deposition could be in quarters that force the child to be even closer to the defendant. The bill could even be used by defense counsel to make it more difficult for the state to use the direct trial testimony of a child, even where the child may testify with little difficulty. The direct trial testimony of a child is almost always the most important part of the state's case. We believe the bill, if amended, may reduce trauma to a particularly traumatized child. However, if the bill is not amended, the bill would empower the defense to increase the potential trauma, not reduce it. Finally, we believe that, as a matter of policy, the decision to seek an alternative to in-court trial testimony should be on the party calling the witness or the witness, not the defendant against whom the witness is called to testify. I've also attached to my written testimony a letter drafted to the head of the Children's Services Division on the general issue of videotape depositions of children. And in that, there's an analysis of the pros and cons and why, overall, the District Attorney's Association, in balance, is opposed to video depositions. To summarize, then, there are a lot of problems with video depositions that, in most cases, will make it more difficult for the child, not less. But if amended, as the District Attorney's Association has submitted, then we would support the bill.
Any other questions, John? Thank you very much for your comments. Appreciate it very much your willingness to share your information. I would ask the committee members read carefully this written testimony that's been presented. And what we're looking at, there's a District Attorney Association. We also have their amendment, which Jacqueline will refer to.
I should mention the material from Mr. Collins is dated February 27. He's got his seal on it, so you could recognize it by that way. You also find in your file some amendments entitled Proposed Amendments to 516. These are amendments. There was a meeting in my office between myself, Corey Streisinger, John Collins, the DA, and a representative of Oregon Criminal Defense Association, David Groom. These are the two things that they agreed on, and that's not to say that, I certainly can't speak for OCDLA, but that's not to say they support the bill. That's simply to say that if this bill were to be passed out, I think the parties are in agreement on these two changes, and we can discuss those more fully later.
What pages do those lines appear on?
Yes.
On page one.
Page three, you'll see that it's stapled to the amendments. There's a hand engrossed copy to make it.
Okay. Thank you.
And I would ask Robert Reed to come forward, who's here to testify from the defense lawyers.
I've prepared a couple of amendments to 516.
Good.
Can I test those out now? They're quick.
Please. Thank you. I need to put your name in these.
Madam Chairman and Senators, the amendments that I proposed are rather brief. One of them speaks directly to the point that was just brought up about the pretrial amendments. The deposition. In line 19 and 21 of the bill, it authorizes, of course, pretrial deposition of the alleged victim.
Page 3? Are you referring to, are these all page 3 amendments?
Pardon me?
They are.
Okay.
Yes.
To ask the people, and we need to begin to train everybody involved here that we're not clairvoyant. We need dates,
okay.
And we need pages. And we need by whom the amendments have been drafted.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'll do that in the future.
We end up getting very sort of piles of information that are progressively refined, and it's very important to the committee.
I understand. I just wrote these early this morning. So,
great. I understand. It's not really directed at you because
you're
not down here regularly, but thanks.
Thank you.
Page 3.
I just wanted to point out that depositions are rarely, if ever, used in criminal cases because of constitutional considerations of the open administration of justice, of confrontation, and the right to cross-examination. They are virtually never used in criminal cases. I see some problems with allowing a pretrial deposition.
not just because of the constitutional considerations, but also once the trial is underway, there will inevitably be other things that the child will have to be cross-examined about. That will require a break during trial during which the child will have to be brought either in court for live testimony, which would, I think, controvert the point of the bill, or for another videotape deposition. The amendment that I proposed basically allows only a during-trial type of examination, either by closed-circuit television or other audiovisual means, which would, of course, include a videotape. The American Bar Association Model Act, which I think much of this original bill, not the amendment, but the original bill was taken from, foresaw that problem. I don't know if you have that, but that basically, that act provided on page 18 for a second video to be taken during trial, which would, of course, result in quite a bit of delays and inefficiency and unnecessary cost. I think the solution that I propose here would solve the problem. It would also be able to, it would allow us all to circumvent any constitutional problems concerning pretrial depositions. I have two other points I'd like to bring up briefly. Again, on the same page of the bill, lines 26 through 28, which basically allow a closed session for examination of the victim, I think definitely pose constitutional problems. When we discussed bills 275, I believe it was previously, a week or two ago, it was brought up the case, maybe it wasn't, but at least in the hallway, some of us discussed Oregon Publishing Company versus O'Leary. For the record, that's at 303 Oregon 297, a 1987 case. That case basically was based upon the Oregon constitutional requirement that justice shall be administered openly. And I will read a sentence from that case. It said that Section 10 is written in absolute terms. There are no explicit qualifications to its command that justice be administered openly. In order to be constitutional, a proceeding must either not be secret or must not administer justice within the meaning of Section 10. That case also said that making a transcript of the hearing available to the public did not meet the constitutional requirements. In this case, I think it might be argued that making the videotape deposition a videotape of the testimony available to the public would cure that problem, but I think that case held otherwise. Also, State versus Bowers, another Oregon Court of Appeals case, for the record at 50 Oregon Appeals, page 1, 1982. That was the same situation as this case, this type of bill would involve. It was a child sex case where the district attorney asked to have the victim taken out of the court, have the public taken out of the court during the testimony. The court reversed that case and held that it, too, was unconstitutional under the same constitutional provision. Finally, the remaining part, I think that would be lines 28 through 34 on that same page. I think we've also discussed the case Coy versus Iowa at 108 Supreme Court 2798, 1988 case. That case, again, was basically on point as far as there being constitutional problems with preventing the defendant from being able to confront directly the victim in the case. By having the victim testify behind a screen, I think you'll directly violate the constitutional mandate of the United States Constitution as expressed in Coy versus Iowa. Also, I don't know how familiar you are with the Oregon Constitution, but it is virtually always construed in a more strict manner than the federal Constitution. The Oregon Constitution also requires face-to-face confrontation. So I think those last two paragraphs will eventually be exposed to vacation by this Oregon Supreme Court. I would urge you not to pass those and require that kind of litigation and expense. That's all I have on that. Are there any questions?
Thank you. Other questions?
Pardon my ignorance on this. You say the last two paragraphs. I was probably drifting when you started. What exactly do you say could come out in order to help this pass constitutional muster?
The first one I brought up was lines 26 through 28, where it starts only the judge and ends during the child's testimony.
Okay, all right. It's what you have on your amendments. I heard you say last two paragraphs, and that stopped
okay.
Because it's all part of a
You're right, paragraph. It is. I had it marked off on my copy here. And also, from the end of that sentence where it says during the child's testimony, all the way to the end, lines 28 through 34, that'd be the second problem, the Coy versus Iowa. I urge you to consult with your counsel on that, and I've sent him the cases. I don't know if he's had a chance to look at those yet.
Thank you. We will circulate around. Are there questions for the questions? Thank you for your amendments.
Thank you.
I do want to hear, let's see what we have. Nola Johnson is here. Trying to look for people who have not had an opportunity to even come before this committee at all. They've made an effort to come down, so I do want to call on Nola. Oh, we do have another, we have another amendment. Please introduce your name for the record, please, and then.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nola Johnson, and I'm here to provide information on Senate Bill 516. My son, Benjamin, is a victim of sexual abuse. I say this in the present tense because even though the original incident occurred 1.5 years ago, when Benjamin was 2 and 3 years old, he remains a victim today. We are both still involved in support group and counseling to help us learn to effectively deal with this trauma. Such counseling is usually necessary for years. It may in fact be a lifelong need. My child goes through many stages of emotional trauma, denial, guilt, fear, and rejection in others because of both the physical and damage that is done. Abusers typically tell the child victim that something terrible will happen, either to the child or to the child's parent. If the victim tells anyone that is happening, in addition, the abuser may tell the child that he or she or her parents will no longer love them if the truth becomes known, or that the abuse is in fact the child's fault. For all of the reasons, it is very difficult for a child to seek help or to accuse the abuser. It is an even more difficult task for a child to stand up in a public forum before the accused abuser and describe the abuse. The child is forced to describe a living nightmare and to see face to face the person who has hurt and threatened and scared them. A child should not be put through a public courtroom procedure that is so scary and so intimidating and brings back all the awful things that happened. Children do not understand the need for courtroom procedures or why they are being forced to do something so frightening to them. They are victimized once by the abuser and a second time by the legal system when they must testify before what has happened in a court of law. I strongly believe that the change allowing videotape or closed circuit testimony of child victims in sex abuse cases is necessary. It is cruel to force children to face their abusers. Our children need our protection. Passing this bill would help create a safer environment for the child who must testify against someone who has hurt them. This concludes my prepared testimony.
Thank you very much for coming. We know it's hard to do, and we appreciate your taking time to share with us your your thoughts.
Appreciate your courage in sharing.
Thank you.
We have people who have to go to a committee. I would like to continue till about 3:15. That's another 10 minutes, and take up at least the people who've come from some distance, who we have not heard from before on any of these bills. We have Laura Sebastian. Is it Sebastian? Okay, we'll pick her up then another time. We have Debbie Tucker from Lake Oswego. Is Debbie here? Pardon? How about Ellen Edna Van Der Zanden from Forest Grove? I'm trying to pick people who we haven't seen.
Thank you. I appreciate that, because I did take off work this afternoon, and I did drive at considerable distance.
It's an interesting Forest Grove accent.
Huh?
That's an interesting Forest Grove accent.
I will explain for the record. My name is Aldina Van Der Zanden. I admire Senator Cohen's attempt at pronouncing my name. I will also explain my accent a little bit before I get started, because I know y'all are probably curious. I am from Texas originally, and I did spend 7 years in Alabama. And so that I have been here for 6 years, and it hasn't gone away, so I don't think it will. It's kind of interesting to see that I don't see anybody I know here.
You infected that whole Van Der Zanden clan with your melody?
Right. There are a lot of Van Der Zandens in Forest Grove. Yes, there are. Anyway, I'm here. I have some prepared testimony. I signed up for three bills, Senator Cohen. I signed up for 275, 516, and House Bill 2367. I think I'm doing good at remembering the numbers. My concern, and y'all can read that. I won't read that for the record. I'll pass it out, and y'all can read that at your leisure. I also, one of the reasons I'm here is because of a $56,000 bubble bath. I mean, you just heard the very poignant testimony of a lady whose child was abused. Okay, there is another side to this. My husband was wrongly accused of sexually abusing his daughter because of a bubble bath he gave her on the Saturday before Easter. To make a long story short, you know, I mean, things got blown out of control. Children's Services Division got involved. The little girl's talking about a secret. She remembers that her father had applied medicine sometime in the past. The man was criminally charged, and it cost my family $56,000 in legal bills. Now, I know that Senate Bill 516 has to do with closed circuit testimony or videotaping. Videotaping is already admissible in court if the defense does not object. In our case, a videotape was done by the CARES program at Emanuel Hospital, supposedly a model program. And I do have some examples in my prepared testimony, which I'll dig out in a minute, about how they do their questioning there. And this is a videotape deposition, you know, it's a videotape thing. And what they basically do is they start out with a premise that there has been abuse, and then they badger the child. The example I give you, I mean, you know, I didn't want to Xerox the gross things they made the little girl say. It's about the little girl testifying whether or not she knows the difference between a truth or a lie. And they say, do you know the difference between a truth or a lie? And she says, nope. And she says, well, what if I held up this green pen and said it was black? Oh, well, you could be teasing me. Oh, well, I think, you know, she asked her a couple more questions. And she says, oh, I think you do know the difference between a truth or a lie. Well, all that proved was that the little girl knew her colors. Now, you know, I've spent $56,000 in legal bills. I also spent a good deal of that was on psychologists. And this is what I've gotten from our extensive psychologists that were involved in our trial, that all that questioning determined was not whether she knew the concept of a truth or a lie, was whether or not she knew that the color green was not the color blue.
Okay, I'm going to interrupt you now and say that probably the same question about truth or a lie, knowing the difference between truth or a lie, would happen whether it was on videotape or in a full.
It is on videotape. I'm sorry I didn't know you had the videotape equipment here, or I would have brought the CARES program videotape and let you see for yourself what they did. And the point I'm trying to make on this is supposedly they're the ones who deem themselves as the objective observer. And they were not objective. And if they're the model program, I would hate to see what some prosecutor would do to people behind closed doors. A second thing on videotaping, and I'm glad I got called up here before CSD, is, you know, part of my I've been very critical of CSD, but I've tried to be constructive in my criticism of the agency. I participated at great personal expense of time and money and time off work in three videotaping panels. And what people were concerned about there were, there were a lot of citizens that came. And the citizens were concerned what they wanted in videotaping was a complete, accurate example, a record of what the CSD worker or what the mental health worker or what this child went through before they made these allegations. Then a couple of lawyers came, and a couple of them are here too. It's good to know that public servants have all, that district attorneys have this all this time where they can come and testify before the legislature. But anyway, several of them testified, and they were concerned about the legal implications, and which has probably led to part of this bill. One of the lawyers that did come from the Defense Lawyers Association was John Henry Hingston. He did not come in person. He sent his secretary with typed testimony, and I have it Xeroxed for y'all also. You might want to see, besides Mr. Robert Reed, who has already testified on behalf of Oregon Defense Lawyers, you might want to read what John Henry Hingston had to say, and he's secretary of the national organization. He gives his credentials in the first, so I won't read his.
Thank you. Are there questions? We will take your testimony. We'll get it put in the proper files with the proper bills. And
I have to, you know, I made 10. I did have another handout, but I'll wait and see if I get to talk again.
You're not going to get to talk again today because we're going to adjourn in 4 minutes, probably.
Okay.
So
okay.
We appreciate all of your handouts, and
okay,
we'll put them in the proper place.
The other one,
just
of
make
course,
sure you get the name, your name attached to them, if you would.
Okay. Thank you. The other one is about the infamous clock case over in Newport. The same people that are involved in the CARES program, supposedly the Model Assessment Center, were involved in the clock case. And, of course, you know, the senator from Newport should be very aware of their
Thank
case.
You.
Thank you.
Let's call Opal Van Comer from Roseburg.
Okay, she's
not here.
I'm Gayla
Steele. I'm on that. Okay. Gayla, come on up. And I hope you can.
I'll
go
get you.
Thank you.
Okay. I'm Gayla Steele from Roseburg, and I am against the videotaping in the court. I mean, I want children into videotape when they're with the CSD counselors, but I am against children the videotaping in court in lieu of the child facing the accuser. I feel that that's our constitutional right. Several times in the history of our nation, we have when we feared for our children, there have been times when we feared for our children, our nation succumbed to hysteria. And one of the times was during the Salem witchcraft trials. And at that time, the judicial branch lowered their standards to allow spectral evidence. If you remember from your history reading that, they began allowing the accusers to testify that the shape or the spirit of the accused had been doing evil deeds. And then they also began allowing a touch test. If the girls went into a frenzy when they touched the accused, then they had uncovered another witch. And it wasn't until a prominent judge's, his own wife was accused, that those trials ended. A more recent time when we feared for our children was during the McCarthy era, when we began looking for a communist under every bed. Many had to publicly defend themselves from innocent statements made earlier in their lives. And remember, it was Congress that allowed individuals' rights to be suspended so that the communists could be found. And now again, I'm fearing that we're facing hysteria brought on by a desire to protect the children. But you must remember that it is the responsibility of this legislative body to keep in perfect balance the desire of children's services to protect children and the protection of the rights of the general public as guaranteed by the Constitution. It is not the time now for you to be taking rights away when we are in the middle of this hysteria. This happened during the Salem witchcraft trials and in the McCarthy era, and we don't want it to happen again. I remind you of the tunnel vision approach that Children's Services has so proudly defined for this. Well, I thought I was going to speak to the same panel, but to the last
okay,
panel.
If you could just quickly,
in
2 minutes,
I'll
read your
testimony. 1 minute. Whenever a child claims abuse, it is believed, and it is up to the accused to prove otherwise. I remind you of your duty as legislators to the whole state and system and its people. Unless you guard the constitutional rights of individuals in this area, 10 years down the road, you too will have lost far more than any of us suspect today. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Grinsky.
I do have to go to the Labor Committee, as does Senator Shoemaker. I want to apologize to those witnesses who maybe you're going to let testify that I won't be able to listen because I have another committee I'm already late for, but yep. I appreciate your coming.
Thank you.
And I have to drive to Klamath Falls this afternoon.
Yes, we do have Ruth Dennison signed up. Okay, we can get you back if you're... Velma, I see. We've heard from Velma before. Bud says he can come back. Judy? The only person I'm interested in... I get Bill Davis, who's come from Winston.
Okay. I'm representing Bill also.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, for the opportunity to address this committee today. I, in fact, represent thousands of people who are falsely accused every year in the state of Oregon. One only need look at the public record that would be supplied to you under the Freedom of Information Act by CSD to see how many people are actually falsely accused in the state of Oregon each year. One thing that's happened is we've relied on a lot of emotion and very little facts in the child abuse cases. I got actively involved not because I was falsely accused, but because a person in a neighboring community who I'd known for many years, who had a daycare, was falsely accused. She was accused because she had fired a teenage girl and the girl became disgruntled. So I began to research the area of false allegations, knowing it was quite risky because not only do we have the District Attorney's Association, who I fear are on the verge of prosecutorial misconduct in many of these cases, but now we have the National Center for the Prosecution of Child Abuse, who comes into the state and actively helps the district attorneys prosecute a case. Now, I'm telling
okay,
you...
I'm going to have to stop you to ask you, could you identify yourself for the record?
I'm Judy Byers. I live in Lebanon, Oregon.
Thank you.
So back to the prosecution. What's happening in many of these cases, I'm going to give you a few cases here in Oregon that maybe you've heard the names. I'm sure Senator Brenneman will recognize the Clark case. The Clark case cost that wonderful young family $85,000. Then, of course, there was the Proctor case. The Proctors, a wonderful black family in Portland, Oregon, took in a foster child, not told by the agency that she had severe emotional problems. The father was falsely accused. Fortunately, a well-known Portland attorney took pity on people because they were poor, they were black, and they were vulnerable. Some of the other cases, the Vanderzantens, I think Eldina mentioned, the $56,000. The Helbergs have spent a lot of money, and the Laudenbecks, a daycare case in